Contra Radio Network presents The Growing Homestead with your host, Rob Alberucci.
All right, I'd like to welcome everybody to an episode of The Growing Homestead. I'm your host, Rob Alberucci, and tonight we have a special guest, a well-known friend of the Contra Radio Network and had his own show for quite a while. We have Brian Kiesler on here from New Mexico West Prepping. Welcome back to Contra.
Yes, sir. It's good to be here.
So, what's been going on with you for a while? We've seen you post some stuff here and there, but as far as hearing from you live, it's been a little while.
Yeah, it's been kind of hectic. I had some personal issues that I needed to deal with family and health, and the whole time I'm trying to keep focused on prepping and keeping the 5-year plan going was kind of a stretch. So I had to take a break, unfortunately, from the radio show for a while I got everything in order and focused on what was most important, which is, you know, the family and the health and all that good stuff.
Absolutely. You have to keep the family because that's what all this is about, right? To protect our family and
make sure
everybody's thriving.
Yes, sir.
So
basically it's been, took me a while to get everything in order. Like I said, it's a lot longer than I thought originally, but you know, that's how the Lord works.
Sure.
You know, you set all kinds of plans and then it's all like, nope. So, but you know, it's good to be kind of back in the loop now.
So now you and I have talked, we've spoken off and on over the last few weeks. You're in the process of moving?
No, not, well, sort of. Our property is going to be ready. The property is going to be paid off in July. And we're moving up there probably about a year from July. Totally moving up there. Until then, there's going to be, every weekend we take things up to the property from our house. So that when we go to move, it'll be like one trip in the back of the pickup truck kind of thing.
Okay, now can you explain to us what is the property?
All right, so about, let's go back just a little bit. My journey started 10 years ago when I bought property out in the middle of the desert in West Texas because of the end of the world was coming and I wanted to get everything ready and I wanted to be where everyone said it was a great place to be. And I got out in the middle of the desert completely and totally unprepared. And if it had been the end of the world, I would have been a statistic because I failed so miserably. I can't even begin to fathom. I mean, I could spend 20 shows talking about how much failure that I had out there in the middle of the desert. So long story short, we ended up moving to a town near West Texas in New Mexico, where I work currently in the oil fields. And then about three and a half years ago, we bought some property over by Arizona, also in New Mexico, up in the mountains at about 7,300 feet in elevation, heavily treed. We did a lot of research before we bought it. One of the things we looked for was an area where the population density was low, meaning that when we get up there, there's nobody there. So the county that we're in has a population density of one person for every 2.4 square miles. And if you take out the county seat, which is about 85 miles away from us, you take that population out of the picture because at 85 miles, no one's going to hike 85 miles in the mountains to come visit us on foot. The population density works out to about one person for every 4.1 square miles. So we found some property up there and we started looking around. We found some property up there that was just a stroke of luck. I'd driven past the property half a dozen times in the last 10 years while I was working, you know, when I was working on the road, self-employed, and never stopped and saw it. So I knew the area, but I never actually stopped and looked for property there. So we ended up getting 10 acres. We paid $1,000 an acre, financed for 4 years. So, and then started the process of preparing that property. The mountains at 7,300 feet in elevation in West Texas is a whole new kettle of fish compared to the desert in West Texas or even the mountains in Colorado. You know, the mountains in Colorado, you get a lot of snow, you get a lot of moisture. In the wintertime, you get, nasty cold weather. Down here, we've had a few days where the temperatures were down around zero, a little bit below zero. I don't really think it got below minus 10 this year at all, at least not that I was aware of. Had a couple of weeks where it was in the teens, but most of the winter up there is in the mid-30s and low, the high 20s to mid-30s for lows, and in the mid-40s to upper 50s for highs. So it's a different kind of mountain environment.
Yeah, when you say that at that 7,000-foot mark, I would have thought that you'd be snow-covered.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and that's just it. Because we are so far south, we do get snow. In fact, actually, they've got three snowstorms coming in through the next 2.5 weeks. They've got three storms predicted to come through and drop a total of somewhere between 8 and 12 inches of snow up there where our property is. A little bit more to the east where there's some higher mountains, and a little bit more to the south where there's some higher mountains. But where our property is, it's about 8 to 12 inches of snow, which out of three storms, I mean, that doesn't sound like much, but for down here, we're all like, oh, that's great. Because, again, it is still New Mexico. And on average, if you look at the environment in New Mexico or even Arizona, it's considered mostly a desert. Most people think, well, it's a desert. But where our property's at, we actually get about 20 inches of rainfall a year up there on average. And this winter, we will have had, with the snow that's coming, we will have had a little over 30 inches of snow for the year, which is consistent with last year's snowfalls. Last winter, 2016-2017, we ended up with about 30-some inches of snowfall as well.
Almost
40 inches.
So then, with being that isolated out there, what is available for, is on-grid power out there, water, you got a well, or what's the plan?
Okay, so there's not much out there. There's a little town near us that has a church. There's no country store. There's a post office there, too. There's a post office and a church. And that's about it. The next closest town is going to be north of us, and that's Ramah. And it's got a Family Dollar. And I think it has a country store and a post office. And it may have a couple of other small places, but it's not much. It's a very small town, like 1,200 population. But that's over on the reservation. And then there's also Zuni, which is, of course, the capital of the Zuni Reservation. And then north of that, of course, would be Gallup. But, yeah, you get out there, and Gallup has everything. They got Home Depot, Walmart, Supercenter, you know, all the basics and grocery stores, gas stations, everything you would need is there. But that's north of there, and that's a waste on the property. So when you make your trips, you have to make sure that you get everything you need. As far as the property goes for its utilities, there's actually power ran on the edge of my property. I actually have power lines. Well, they're actually right across the street from my property, but they're right there at the edge of the property. But they wanted $5,000 to drop a meter on my property, and I was like, how about no?
Right, yeah.
So, I have 6 years of complete and total utter failures for experience in solar. You know, I've actually gone through all the basic mistakes you'd ever want to make with solar to the point where, you know, now I've pretty much got the hang of solar, and I know how solar works, and I don't have any problems with that. I've got a 5,000-watt power plant. I've got an 8,000-watt split-phase pure sine inverter that runs my house up there, and it runs right into the breaker boxes like a regular house. So when you walk in my house and you turn a light switch on, everything comes on. You turn on the electric dryer, and the dryer comes on. You turn on the washer, and the washer comes on. We don't have a well currently. There's no water available up there as far as, like, public utilities. I don't even know where the nearest water line is. I'm going to guess it's probably about 75 miles away.
Do you have an idea of the depth that you would have to go for a well?
Yeah, actually, water's not very deep up there compared to when I was in the desert in West Texas. We're talking 1,000 to 1,200 feet for a well, and about $20,000 to $40,000 just for $25,000 just for the well, no casing.
Wow.
$40,000 to $45,000 with a cased well, and you're talking anywhere from 1 to 3 gallons a minute of flow at that depth.
Right.
So there's not much water out there, which is one of the things I learned real quick. The water depths up there where the property's at, my neighbor to the west, who is just a weekend property for him, he's only been out there 2 or 3 times in the last year. It's one of those kind of properties. He dug a well, and he hit water about 375 feet, and they went to 425, and he's getting them, I think he said, 4 gallons, 4.5 gallons a minute of flow, which doesn't sound like a lot, but, you know, that's more than what you need, really. I mean,
sure.
All you need is enough water to, you know, the pump runs for 20 minutes and fills up where you've used 60 or 80 gallons.
Right.
And then the next closest well from there is going to be neighbors to the northeast, but they're a little ways away. And their well, again, they've got an RV up there, but they're only up there. I think I've only seen a car there twice this year. So they're only up there a little bit as well. And their well is 425, and they went to 475 or 80, and they're getting 6 gallons a minute of flow.
See,
so
now,
they're all in the same area and about the same consistency for water flow.
See, now, when you say that water isn't very deep up there, I'm used to here in southeast Indiana, my neighbor's well is, I think, he's around 29 feet, and I think he went to 32. And he's getting between...
Right, yeah, so you're not going to...
And he's getting about 8 gallons a minute.
Right, so you're not going to be hand-digging wells out here.
Yeah.
Again, you are still... Ultimately, you have to remember that you are still in New Mexico.
Right.
And it is a desert arid environment. Even the mountains where we're up in the pine trees, if you look around, it's really high plains desert. I mean, there's a lot of grasses that grow 2-3 feet tall, and a lot of pinyon pines and a lot of cedars. To the south of us, there's a lot of ponderosas, which get up about 60 or 80 feet. But up where I'm at, most of your trees are in the 30 to 40 foot range for your tall trees, and those are your pinyons. And those are there's some really big pinyons up there that I've gained. I always thought pinyon pines were about 20 foot tall, but up there they get up about 30, 40 foot tall. There's some old ones up there.
So I guess
but
you
as
don't.
As far as like,
sorry, go ahead. Yes, there's not much hardwood up there, though, is there? The oaks and the locusts?
Cedar is a hardwood.
Okay.
Cedar is considered a hardwood. It's one of the softer hardwoods, but it is considered a hardwood.
Gotcha.
So as far as that goes, no, there's nothing. There's no oaks. There's no birches. There's no beechwoods. There's no none of your maples or your, you know, those trees, that, you know, the black walnuts or anything like that.
Sure.
So once later on this year, the well's going to go in, and that's going to run me. Now I have a discount because I have a friend that does one of the benefits of working in the oil fields. You make friends with people who drill wells.
I would imagine.
I have a friend of mine. God bless him. He drills wells, and he's agreed to punch me a well for the cost of the parts and some good steaks on the grill while he's there. So it's still going to cost me about $5,000 for parts.
Okay.
A normal well in this area, you're looking at $12,000 to $14,000 for a well, and that's going to be your most expensive. I mean, my land was cheap. You go up into where you're at in Indiana, you're not going to buy land for $500, $600, $800 an acre, $1,000 an acre.
No.
Unless you're out in the middle of nowhere and you happen to come across a piece of land that somebody, you know, has no clue what they're holding on to.
Right. I'm a good half hour from any kind of a large grocery store or a Home Depot or something like that. And we paid right around $8,000 an acre. There are more areas where they're just out in no man's land, and you can still find it for $1,500, maybe $2,000. But your hills, where I'm at, I'm considered a farm ground where we got pasture.
Right. Well, see, and I wanted to be up higher in elevation. A long time ago, when I first got into this, I saw some horrible maps that depicted America with a big lake, and we actually talked about this earlier today.
Yep.
Which is one of the reasons why I went up in elevation, not down, because me and my wife had talked about moving to maybe Arkansas, and we couldn't get over there's always that possibility. And then, is it going to happen? Probably not. There's a whole lot of things that are worst case scenarios. We talked about another one earlier today with the
grand solar minimum
that we're going into, and the poles slipping, and you know, and there's scientists that are saying, look, if this happens, and you know, you're going to have protons coming in from space that are going to kill everything. Well, I said, you know, you can't prepare for everything. You have to keep your mind focused.
Right.
So, but back to what we were talking about as far as like properties. When I looked for property, there was a couple of requirements that I had. Okay, and this is where my requirements are not going to be anybody else's requirements. I based my requirements off of having been out in the desert in the middle of nowhere and the obstacles that I ran into out there, as opposed to what I needed to live comfortably. Now, mind you, out in the West Texas desert, we average 7 inches of rainfall a year. And yet I had enough rainfall catchment that I could fill up 15,000 gallons of water a year off of that rainwater catchment.
Wow.
So I could live off that comfortably at 7 inches of rainfall. So if you do the math on that, at 20 inches of rainfall up in the mountains, I'm going to collect somewhere around 30,000 gallons of water easily, which, you know, is more than enough water to live off of. And that's just from my rainwater catchment. There's a whole lot of – I've designed a whole lot of redundancies into my design in the mountains. So that I don't have to stress about what if, you know, what if the pump fails on my well? What if there's a CME after the grand solar minimum causes massive unrest and the economy collapses? And then we have a CME come in and it wipes out all my electrical pumps. Well, I still have rainwater catchment. So there's also within walking distance of my house about not quite a mile away, actually a little bit over a mile away, right around a mile away, is a windmill that runs a well. And, you know, all that needs is grease a couple of times a year, and that thing will run forever. And it's pumping out water from the same depth as where my well will be. So the water's good water coming out of the well. You just have to sanitize it after it gets into the cattle trough, because there's a whole lot of bacteria that grows in cattle.
Right.
I catch
water here as well, and we have about an 8,000 gallon tank that's buried in the ground. Now the footprint of my house is about 1,600 square feet. When you factor in the pitch of the roof and all that kind of stuff, it will go up a little bit. I've kind of calculated by watching my cistern that if we get an inch of rain, it puts between 2,000 and 3,000 gallons in my tank off my roof.
Yep. So, and that's exactly about what I've got a little bit more than that as far as roofing goes, but that's because like my RV, I put a roof over. My shell that I have up there that I'm using for a battery house now, or a powerhouse now, is 12x24 metal roof. The powerhouse, when it goes in, metal roof, every roof I have goes into rainwater collection.
Mm-hmm.
On the backside of my property, not even calculated into my rainwater collection figures, is a rainwater runoff where the hills, because there's about 100-foot elevation now, 75-foot elevation difference between where my property's at and the hills, and the top of the hills behind me. So all that rainwater comes down off that hill, and it runs right through the west side of my property. So that's going to eventually get a hole dug about 20 foot deep and about 80 feet across, 80 feet around, and it's going to get a liner put in it, and it's going to get an overflow line put in, a line put into it, and rocks on the gravel on the dam, so, you know, for stability and all that. But that's not even figured into my rainwater calculations. So, I mean, that's just extra. And that's going to get a pump house put next to it with a 12-volt pump in it and some 12-volt panels on the roof. And whenever the water fills up, I can always pump it into my 15,000 gallons of storage that I have in the event that they're getting low. So I actually got way sidetracked. So I was getting ready to go into what my requirements for. I do that a lot. I do that a lot on my show, too.
Yeah.
I have that. My oldest daughter calls it something shiny-itis.
Well,
there's something shiny over there.
Well, and then when you're on, and when we would do the Facebook Live, you would start to watch the comments, and then that would just drive you way off topic, too. I had that problem, which I'm kind of like a squirrel after a nut anyway. I'm all over the place as it is.
So the basic requirements that I had for my property were what I needed to live. Okay, I need the ability to have firewood for heat. I needed someplace where I got at least 16 inches of rainfall a year so that I get enough rainwater to collect to water an orchard, as well as a garden. Now, my orchard is not—it's not a big orchard. When it's all said and done, I'm going to have about 20 trees.
Okay.
Between the apples and peaches. I've got apples and peaches now. I've got three apples and three peaches that are growing just fine up there, except that the elk got to them because I left the gate open one night when I was there. But I mean, they're still growing. There's, instead of being 12 feet tall, they're about 5 feet tall. And the elk were all happy that day.
Yeah.
But I wanted to make sure that there was, like I said, rainwater, enough rain to cover what we needed for watering purposes, which we've got more than what we need. And that 20 inches of rainfall doesn't even take into consideration the snowfall each year. That's just rainfall. So you have the snow falling, we get about 6 inches of snow. It's usually a pretty dry snow, like a powdery snow. So we get about 5 to 6 inches of snow per inch of rainfall. So 30 inches of snowfall is 5 more inches of rain. So now we're at 25 inches of rainfall for the year. I wanted to make sure that the property taxes were cheap so that in the event that I decide to retire the property, which I'm doing summer of next year, that's actually my goal. I won't have to come up with the $10,000 a year for a property tax payment. You go in some of these counties up in Colorado, yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah.
You know, and there's areas all over the country like that. You know, anything on the East Coast is out of the question as far as I'm concerned, because the property taxes are just ridiculous. I lived out there for a long time. So, you know, you get to, and I wanted to be up in elevation at least 5,000, 5,500 feet minimum. So that in the event that there was any kind of catastrophic issues, that I'd be up above all of that. I also looked for an area that was fairly calm and didn't have any active faults. To me, that's really important, especially with the coming magnetic pole flip that they're talking about that's on its way here. And for those of you who are not aware of this, the poles have been slowly moving over the last umpteen years. However, the last, I guess, 10 years now, they've been moving. They picked up a lot of speed.
Right.
The North Pole is now somewhere in Siberia, and the South Pole has actually left Antarctica and is headed towards Southeast Asia, South Pacific. So if you actually today, I actually yesterday and today, because I was checking today to make sure my calculations were correct. If you look where North's at and you pull out a compass, my compass points about a quarter inch to the right of where North should be. And that's because the poles are moving. So that's just something to keep in mind. As that gets further in, they're predicting the poles are going to flip somewhere between 2030 and 2040, I think. But there's no one really knows. No one knows. I mean, there's so many. The last time the poles flipped 784,000 years ago, I can tell you right now, there was nobody that's alive right now out there forecasting all this stuff alive, or anybody to document it even.
Right.
So, you know, it's one of those things that nobody knows. It's a whole lot of unknowns, and that freaks everybody out, especially, you know, those of us who prep.
Right. Sure. Yeah, I mean, a lot of what we talk about is just all speculation. I mean, especially in America, we don't know the struggles that that they've had to deal with in other nations, especially. But I mean, as far as the effects of an EMP, yeah, it's they've done their tests and we kind of guess. And the effects of a pole shift, we kind of guess. So we do the best we can and prepare for everything we can. When I work on my preps, I don't really prep for any specific event. I kind of just base everything being able to live off grid. If I can live without grid power, without electric, whatever, I think I stand a decent fighting chance. Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to be able to handle the big Mongo earthquake, or if the poles shift and my area does flood and I'm 100 feet underwater. Well, you know, there is only so much. Yeah, right. So anyway,
yeah, and that's what I was saying earlier, is that you can only prepare for so much. You have to keep focused on the realities and what you know you can survive. And that's what I prepare for. I mean, I prepare more for an economic collapse because I've been in other countries while they were going on, while I was in the military. And as far as economic collapse goes, I also kind of prepare for a grid down scenario. So it's like a combination for me, because that's my biggest concern, is if the grid goes out, a lot of people don't understand the repercussions of the grid in America going down. So if it does happen someday, it'll be catastrophic, I can tell you that.
Well, and then I think that will get right into a civil unrest, just because everybody will be spazzing out and freaking out.
And the grid down leads into an economic collapse, which, like I said, a lot of my preps are self-sufficiency preps. Raised bed gardening, the Wallapini, which I talked to you about. A lot of people aren't familiar with what a Wallapini is.
What the heck's a Wallapini?
It's basically a berry greenhouse. You dig down 6-8 feet, and what you're doing is you're using the natural heat that comes from the dirt at that depth to provide warmth in the wintertime, so that your greenhouse doesn't get as cold in the wintertime. I've read a lot. I haven't built mine yet. I've got it in the works. I've already marked it off. It'll be happening sometime later this year. By the end of this year, it'll be in place. And I'll shoot you some pictures. You can throw them up there. But by the end of this year, it'll be in place. And I've read a few things where a properly designed and built one will take, if the outside temperature is 20 degrees, it'll heat it to 120 degrees inside in the middle of the day in the winter. So, but you have to build them properly, and there's a whole lot of calculations that have to go into play on that.
All right, so
we've also incorporated geothermal heating and cooling into ours as well. So
I mean, is this thing completely underground, or is it half and half, half exposed? Is it?
Well, you dig down 6-8 feet on the walls, and then you design it so that your roof points at the right angle. You have to get a specific angle depending on where you're at in the country. It's gonna be different for every single place, because it has to be in line with where you are, latitude, longitude, latitude. Isn't latitude? Yeah, latitude's the north south thing. I always get those two confused.
Right.
But yeah, and you get it at just the right angle, and what it does is it catches the sun perfectly in the wintertime, so you make your roof out of something that's either polycarbonate or glass. You repurpose windows. Mine's going to be probably repurposed windows or polycarbonate. The glass is just too expensive. But I mean, you can get, there's a place down here called, Reuse It. But they sell used, non-broken building materials. So you can go buy windows. You can go buy windows for $10 a window. And what you're doing is you're reusing windows that people have gone and remodeled their house and pulled their windows out. And then the company that pulls them out sells them to this company for a little bit of nothing. And then this company sells them for a little bit of nothing. So there's no waste. You don't have the landfills filling up with all this good building material. I mean, you can buy lumber, doors, roofing material, windows, you name it. So, but that's what ours is. And then what you do once you've got that done is you put plastic underneath it. You can also put plastic on the outside, just like a regular plastic greenhouse. If you get the real thick plastic, you can do the plastic, and you do two layers, so there's an air pocket in there, and that air pocket prevents, it acts as insulation and prevents the cold air from coming in, but lets the light in and the heat in the wintertime. So we're doing one. My wife agreed to do one that, as long as one end of it has a room for a hot tub, which I mean, we talked about that earlier too. I specifically designed my solar power plant. Remember that hole? I wanted to build it. You know, through all my failures, I finally came to the decision that when I move up here, and if the world goes to you know where in a handbasket, I want to be able to live some semblance of normalcy. And you know, what's more normal than after a long hard day of work in the hot tub, and you know, when it's got snow on the ground outside. So I designed my system so that I can run that hot tub, one of the smaller ones, like a four person.
Mm-hmm.
I can run that off of my power plant that I've designed.
So so then inside your inside this greenhouse or this wall of peony, are you going to do like thermal mass with like the barrels,
yep,
of water that
yep,
help hold the heat?
Yeah. I'm going to do barrels of water on the north wall. That way the light coming in from the south will hit and provide warmth as well. We're also doing geothermal heating though. So what we're going to do is we're going to dig down and build a trough that goes out 40 feet and then build an S grid with piping. And then run it all back into there, and then put a 240 millimeter fan on a 6-inch pipe, and that a 12 volt fan, like a case fan for your computer, because
uh-huh,
you can buy them dirt cheap, and that will provide airflow. It'll suck the air in there, and then slowly push it back out, and that'll provide enough warmth from the ground. Basically, geothermal heating, you get your heat in the wintertime will run about 50, 55 degrees. So it won't bake you out. But at the same time, it'll prevent you from freezing as well. You know, and of course, that temperature is dependent 100% on where you're at geologically, where you're at, geographically. How far down you go, and all that good stuff. But basically down here, the permafrost is about 12 inches. So I have a friend of mine that's from Wisconsin. He said, yeah, the permafrost up there is about 8 feet. And he's not exaggerating. Literally it. When you get temperatures that are, you know, in the negative 10s during the day for highs and negative 30s at night for lows for 2 weeks straight, it doesn't take long for that ground to freeze 4, 5, 6, 8 feet down. And once it freezes, it's spring before it warms up. So actually said the permafrost is about 6 foot, and they dig all their trenches 8 foot.
Yeah.
So when you're putting in your water lines, all their stuff's 8 foot deep. All my stuff is 24 inches deep.
Where I'm at, we bury everything about 3 feet is our standard frost line.
Yeah, the permafrost here, like I said, is about 12 inches, so I just doubled that, and we go 24 inches on all of our pipes. I've never had a pipe freeze.
Right.
So, I mean, that works fine. And that's something else, too, that we took into consideration, you know, was the amount of cold temperatures during the day. We're in New Mexico, but in the summertime, because we're so high in elevation, last year we had 2 days over 100 and about, I think it was 12 days over 90. And the rest of the days were in the mid to upper 80s during the daytime, and the low to mid 60s at night, sometimes in the upper 50s. But I mean, and that's great weather.
Yeah, that's excellent weather.
You can't beat that. Yeah, so, you know, I'm still far enough south that the winters are real mild, but I'm high enough in elevation, so the summers are real mild too. It's like a win-win there.
Gotcha.
Basically the wall of peony we designed is 10 feet by 40, and of course on the end of it is a 10 by 10 room, so the actual greenhouse part of it's only 10 by, actually there's two extra rooms. One of them is going to have the methane digester in it, so the actual greenhouse is 10 by 24, and then there's a 6 by 10 room that will have a methane digester in it. That way the methane digester stays pretty close to 60 degrees all winter long. And then the other room on the very end will have the hot tub.
Well, that sounds...
And the hot tub is separate because I don't want the humidity getting in there and promoting mold. Everything that's designed for the Wallapini is designed with drip irrigation. So it's all very micromanaged as far as the water consumption goes. And that's something I learned out in the desert. And again, when I discuss out in the desert, when I talk about out in the desert, my goal when I was out in the desert was to perform genocide on plants. I succeeded in that. I tried everything I could grow out there. After 3 years in the desert, I managed to grow blackberries. I had a blackberry briar out there. It was about 10 feet around and was growing like crazy. I had blueberry plants before the goats ate them 3 times. They were bigger around than, it would have taken 3 of me to go around one bush. And they were taller than I am tall. Now, mind you, I'm not tall, but I'm still 5'8". They were big, tall. I've never seen blueberry bushes that tall. They were ridiculous. So it's all about what you can learn, how to adapt to the environment. But.
Sure. Well, I think I'm going to probably stop this show.
All right.
We're over the half hour mark. I would like to see, I don't even think we've dipped into much of what you got going on out there. So I'd like to see if you would like to, come back again this following Monday and we'll get into into what you're planting, what you're growing and all that stuff and animals and livestock and all kinds of stuff to get into.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in the works up there. A lot of the stuff like the livestock we can't get till we get up there full time. But we've got a lot of stuff in line and we're prepping the property for it. So, yeah, I'd love to come back next Monday.
That'd be excellent. So
awesome. It's great talking to you.
Yep. Same here. Well, that'll be it for now. Like I said, we'll get Brian back on here again. We're going to dig into this deeper. So, but for right now, it's good night to everybody.
All right. God bless everybody.